Welcome again to Cinema Squabble. This is episode number 41. Adam Gerke, Sarah Michelle Fetters, Mike Ward from shouldiseeit.net. You're back with us.
I am. I just stumbled in here and you guys put me on the microphone.
As a matter of fact, that's exactly how it works, right? And who are we? What do we do? A number of Seattle's film critics. We gather in theaters several times a week. We sit in the front row. We throw popcorn at the screen. We talk about what we've seen and what do we like? What do we not like? We bring that conversation to you now in podcast form. That's kind of the gist of it. And we're kind of in the dregs of the summer at this point.
Kind of.
The whole summer's been the dregs. Yeah. This is something we're going to discuss
a
little bit later. So we'll talk about summertime films, how the season has gone, and also a number of films that are out last week and also this week. And
based on our last show and based what's going to happen, I think, on this show, mm-hmm. I'm not sure we could actually say we're in the dregs of the summer, because typically it is the dregs of the summer.
Right.
Except there's been a lot of good films released in the part of the summer that usually sucks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very weird.
These last 2 weeks of August are not a dumping ground. There's some good stuff out there.
Right. So that being said, Kubo and the Two Strings, Sarah, you saw this. Mike, you saw this as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Sarah, give us the setup on this. Tee this up for us.
Kubo and the Two Strings is the new movie from Laika Studios. They're the ones behind the stop-motion enterprises Paranorman, Coraline, The mm-hmm. Box Trolls.
Mm-hmm.
And much like those, this is another stop-motion animated motion picture. I liked Coraline.
Mm-hmm.
I loved The Box Trolls. Mm-hmm. I loved Paranorman. Kubo and the Two Strings might be their masterpiece.
Wow.
This might be the best movie they've made so far.
And to help people understand, just so that to dial this back for a second, for stop-motion animation. So if you're familiar with Tim Burton and Danny Elfman in The Nightmare Before Christmas.
You got it.
These are little figurines that are, they take a picture, they move them, take a picture, move them. This isn't like sketches or drawings. This is the old school animation, and this is the way they do it. So, and you're saying this is their masterpiece.
This is maybe their masterpiece.
Okay, so tell us.
It's a phenomenal movie. It's a movie about a young boy named Kubo who tells stories. He's a street urchin, lives in a cave with his mother. He goes into town and tells these marvelous stories using origami and his little three-string guitar. And the entire town comes and they're just fascinated by his tales of daring do and samurais performing these amazing deeds, battling monsters and other evildoers.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out, though, these stories are all based on fact.
Hmm.
So his mother has actually been protecting him from her two sisters and his grandfather, the Moon King, all of whom can only see him at night. So he's not allowed to go out at night.
Hmm.
But one evening, he stays out a little too long and is discovered. Thus, he has to go on this great adventure throughout all of Japan to find a magic armor, a magic sword, and a magic helmet to help defeat the Moon King, his grandfather.
Hmm.
Along the way, he picks up a monkey,
mm-hmm.
and he picks up a giant beetle who used to be a samurai.
Okay, so this has elements or shades of what I would call Japanese animation, right? Is that right to say that? I mean,
the Japanese influences.
We have suspension of disbelief. We have kind of the surreal coming and going throughout this. Is that, I mean, that's kind of often one of the traits that we see in a lot of their
animations. I mean, here is one of the slight criticisms of the film is that it is a Caucasian film.
Okay.
And that, I mean, the filmmakers, the writers, and pretty much the entire main vocal cast, they're all Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, the movie honors Japanese storytelling and Japanese traditions in a way that is really just wonderful. And I have not heard any criticism from anybody on that front.
No,
and
not
I don't
at all.
Think there should be any. It is a, much like the Kung Fu Panda series really honors Chinese storytelling and Chinese folklore, even though it is a very much an American production. I think you could say the same thing about Laika has done here with Kubo and the Two Strings. It honors Japanese storytelling. It honors the Japanese culture and it honors Japanese lore. It is a little disconcerting to hear Matthew McConaughey's voice coming out of a samurai beetle.
All right, all right, all right.
He's good. He does a great job. But I mean, it is a Japanese samurai beetle that
sounds like Matthew
McConaughey. Yeah, exactly. I didn't have as big a problem with Charlize Theron being the monkey because she's a monkey.
Right.
I can't really say anything on that front. I do also wish that the Japanese actors that they do have in the movie would have had a little bit more to do.
One of which is George Takei.
Who, again, is
really
great.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really get enough to do, unfortunately.
That's true.
But The animation is spectacular. The script is spectacular. The vocal work by the young boy who plays Kubo, newcomer Art Parkinson, is again spectacular. Yeah. The movie has set pieces that blow you away. Mm-hmm. It's Pixar level storytelling, and we're saying Pixar when Pixar is at their absolute best.
Right, and Pixar is very known for dialing in almost perfect storylines.
And this is as close to perfect as you can get. And more than that, when it comes to the big, huge, spectacular finish, yes, it's visually stunning, and yes, it's exciting. But again, like the best of Pixar, it comes down to a reliance on community, mm-hmm. a reliance upon family, and a reliance upon self, not because you're just this big, huge hero who can do extraordinary things. It's actually being able to say, I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's about able to forgive somebody. It's a wonderful movie. It's just perfect for all ages, and I was in rapture watching it.
Sure. Mike, what are your thoughts?
Sarah said everything I would say. This movie is phenomenal, and it's one of the best films I've seen this year, mm-hmm. clearly. Also, I would say it's one of the best animated films of the decade.
Wow.
And I'm not saying it's the best. I mean, I'm not going to jump to that yet because I need to think of that through. But I can tell you, watching it, I had some, I wouldn't say resistance, but I was a little curious because it felt like a film that doesn't fall in line with what Laika has done.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something that comes over you when you watch the movie, and Sarah touched on a lot of it. Any walls that you put up to this is, you know, it's a samurai story. It's going to have all this action. It's not going to rope in, you know, it's going to be, you know, for a certain demographic. It's not going to speak to everybody. That just washes away because you get these layers. You know, the screenplay is so well thought out. You know, it's less about adventure and more about all these other things like community and family that Sarah was talking about. And I got blindsided by that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's actually, you know, there are moments in the film that are surprisingly emotional, and you don't get that from watching the trailer, and you don't get that from seeing some of the clips that they've shown, plus painstaking animation. There are sequences in here that rival some of the best things we've seen from action movies this year.
Oh, yeah, without
and
a
doubt. It's incredible. And they do peel the curtain back in the end credits on one great. Amazing sequence. But it just taps into all these emotions that I don't think people realize is going to be in the film, and that's its payload. That's where it scores.
Mm-hmm.
And it's astonishing.
I'll also say it's another one of those movies where we don't give enough credit to animated films for the below-the-line craftsmanship. This is one of those films where, much like, say, the first Kung Fu Panda or How to Train Your Dragon or some of the better Pixar films, where you could say, if the Academy was just... If the Academy was honest, if the technical members in the Academy wanted to be fair,
mm-hmm.
Kubo and the Two Strings should at least be in consideration to be nominated for production design.
Absolutely.
It should be in consideration to be nominated for costumes.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is perfect on a lot of these intimate technical levels
mm-hmm.
that go far above and beyond anything we actually see in a live action film.
Yeah.
And it's just as painstakingly, you know, put together and realized.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, I'm obviously picking up on the fact these are two strong theater recommendations from both of you on this.
Yeah, absolutely.
It could end up in my top 10 at the end of the year. I mean, it's a fantastic film.
Yeah. And I think, Sarah, you were also mentioning to me the difference between Laika and what Pixar does is Laika, their workflow is a little different. They like to get through a project, finish it off, be done with it. And then they start their next project, where Pixar often has like 10 in the can, like ready to go, so they can just churn these things out. They've got their workflow down
a little
bit
more. I mean, you know, Pixar is part of Disney.
Right.
So, I mean, the time frame to make one of these movies is probably the same. It's 3, 4, 5 years.
Right.
But when you're Pixar, you can have 3, 4 movies in production at the same time
right.
so that they can come out 1 year after the other after the other.
Yeah.
So everybody's wanting to make this big deal that Laika's on this amazing run that's better than anything Pixar has done. People forget Pixar puts out a movie every year. It still takes them 3 to 4 years to make that movie.
Yeah.
Right.
But they're a giant corporation at this point. Laika, for all of their success, they're just out over in Portland, by the way, so everybody say hi. You know.
Yeah.
Hi, we're here in Seattle.
Wave as you go by.
Wave.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have the ability to have 3 stop motion animated films in production at the same time.
Well, their studio partner is Focus Features.
Exactly.
I mean, which so essentially it's you can almost envision it's okay, wow, we got Coraline done. Okay, can we get the financing for this next idea we have? I mean, it almost feels like they're having to go bridge from event to event to event to get their movies made.
Right. Sure. And so they get more time to spend.
Yeah, yeah.
And they get to focus. Their whole entire creative team gets to focus on one thing at a time.
Oh, very cool. So, all right. Kubo and the Two Strings, two strong theater recommendations from the Squabblers. War Dogs, another film that came out last week.
This is not going to match.
This is not going to sit there on that list. Not at all by any stretch of the imagination. The gist on this, let me give you the kind of the nuts and bolts on this. You've got two high school friends, David Packhouse and Ephraim Divaroli. Now, David Packhouse is played by Miles Teller. And Ephraim Divaroli, Jonah Hill. They're two kind of screwballs in a way.
Sure.
Ephraim a little more screwball-ish than David. And David is basically wasting his life away as a massage therapist in, is it Hollywood? Is that where they're at?
I believe so. I can't remember.
Somewhere. I think he's in California, Simi Valley, something like that.
This is off to a great start.
Yeah. Wasting his life as this massage therapist, then turns to selling sheets to nursing homes.
Which is actually kind of a cool moment.
It is a cool bit.
Pretty fantastic.
We'll get to that in just a second real quick. The two of them actually meet up again. Turns out Ephraim has keyed into arms sales. This is how he's making his fortune. And turns out that, he needs a partner to work with him on selling arms to the U.S. government, sort of through a loophole, sort of through a online bidding process that happens within the U.S. military. And this is all based on a true story.
Like, I could do this?
Yes. You could do this.
It's all true.
Sweet. If you could source the weapons, if you could source the Glocks, if you could source, and you knew a way to ship these to Afghanistan or to Iraq or wherever the U.S. needs them, you could make a bid on this.
You got a pen? I'm going to just take some notes.
Right. So Ephraim sets up this company, AEY, basically pulls his buddy in on this, David, and it turns into the situation where they are picking up these little teeny clients or these little teeny jobs. They call them crumbs. To the major weapons dealers, these are things they wouldn't even waste their time with, but crumbs are good enough and they're surviving. They're making millions on this. Then comes the whale, this big, awesome, monstrous job, and they're like, holy smokes, how would we pull this off? Enter in arms dealer banned in the U.S., banned from doing work with the U.S. government, whose name completely escapes me, but it's played by Bradley Cooper. And so Bradley Cooper appears for a moment, says, hey boys, I will help you out on this because I see you're in trouble. The legalities of making this happen are really tough. You need the weapons. I've got a line on all this stuff. It happens to be in Albania. And I'll get you this stuff at a deal. So I'll sell all this to you for a deal. You then in turn sell it back to the government, and we all win. We all come out ahead.
There you go.
That's the gist of it. You get that from the trailer. You get that from me, and you don't get a whole heck of a lot else. There's a little bit of humor involved. Mm-hmm. And you see it all in the trailer.
You get that from the trailer too.
Yeah, there is literally nothing more that I could give you about this film that would leave you in suspense or hang you out and make you go, ooh, 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 me too, I want to see this. Other than the fact if you're trying to come up with a get-rich-quick scheme that might work for you.
Right.
That's about the longest I can go with this. The other thing I'll say on this, and Sarah and I are going to differ on this a little bit.
We're going to differ a little bit, just a little bit.
Having interviewed Jonah Hill at least once in person, and then seen him interviewed multiple times on studio talkbacks when he's done other press tours and things for other films. Jonah Hill, I'm just going to say it right now, he's a jerk. He is a jerk to press in general. He doesn't ever really seem to. People expect him to be the fun, jovial guy, the characters that we often see. He likes to portray the, I am important, I am a producer, I'm a serious actor, don't portray me as this goofball.
Heard this many times.
And I don't have a problem with that. But when you are trying to sell a film that does have a hint of humor to it, it would help if you could be nice to the people and at least laugh a little bit with them and enjoy the moment and enjoy your moment in the sunshine. So I know Jonah to be a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
This film portrays him as a jerk. And I go, this guy isn't even acting. He's just sitting here. He's just reading the lines they put in front of him.
He's phoning it in.
He's totally phoning it in is how I see this. Sarah, you disagree.
I would disagree on that just because I think it is actually a pretty good performance. And I mean, that's the point of the character. The character is a self-centered jerk.
Yeah.
The character, he's an ass.
Yeah.
I mean, And
so
I think,
is
and
it
I
a
think,
stretch?
But I think Jonah Hill actually brings that to life quite nicely. I think he does a good job in the film. It's not quite to the same level as what he brought to, say, Wolf of Wall Street, mm-hmm. which is a very similar character.
But that is different, that, where I actually respect the acting he brings
to
that.
Well, that had some more levels to it, that had some more nuance to it. This doesn't have that. I still think he's good here. Mm-hmm. I think the reason there aren't those levels and there isn't that nuance is because at this point, I just don't know what to say anymore about Todd Phillips. Todd Phillips is the co-writer and the director mm-hmm. of this movie. He's the guy that made the Hangover films. He also made Due Date, and he made Old School, and he's
right.
Done,
we would expect him to be a funny guy in perhaps this. Maybe?
Not so much. I think he is funny. But what I'm saying with Todd Phillips is that Todd Phillips goes for the obvious gag, and he can't go any deeper than that.
Yeah.
This is a movie that is ripe for some really dark, gritty, nasty Dog Day Afternoon level satire. Mm-hmm. Some network level satire. You know what? You want to see a good movie about illegal arms running that is technically state sponsored? Mm-hmm. Watch Lord of War with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
That movie is kind of fantastic and ended up being really ahead of its time as mm-hmm. far as this subject matter was concerned. Yeah. I think it was released in, 2005, 2006, somewhere around there. But whatever. Yeah. I mean, that movie hits all of the same points, talks about all of the same things, did it in a way that is biting and incisive and dark. Mm-hmm. This movie doesn't have the balls to ever get dark.
Yeah.
and I guess in the end what I'll say is, the press screening for this was the same night as Kubo and the Two Strings. I could only choose one. I went to Kubo and the Two Strings. I still went to go see this movie.
Yeah.
The movie left me in a state of meh mm-hmm. that was so large, I didn't even bother writing a review.
Yeah.
I do not have a review on the website only because I just don't care.
Yeah. So where would you put this? Theater, rent, skip? Are you going to go rental or are you going skip?
You know, I would actually probably, even though I do like Jonah Hill in it, I think Miles Teller does a nice job. Mm-hmm. I actually, somebody that we're not going to talk about much today, unfortunately, because we're not going to talk about Hands of Stone, but Ana de Armas, who is the woman in this movie,
yeah.
I think she's excellent, and she's even better in the Robert De Niro boxing movie, Hands of Stone, that comes out this week as well. She's a major talent, a major find. I think she's excellent in this. She's even better in that. I would still go skip, though, just because the movie just doesn't do anything. It just falls flat, and it doesn't have... It never wants to go for the jugular.
No.
And you can't do a satire about this sort of subject if you're not going to go for it. If you're not going to rip out the throat, then what's the point?
Yeah. And I'm skip with you right there as well. So, flush! Sound effect
yeah,
if we had
that
it.
It's better, you know, but the thing is, I would much rather watch War Dogs 5 times in a row than the other flush from last week.
Oh, right, which was, well...
Which should never have been as bad as it was.
A biblical spectacular, nonetheless. Mike, we're getting into Ben-Hur here.
Hold on.
$100 million to remake Ben-Hur.
A monstrous...
Monster
of a film. And
imagine,
I mean, we're all familiar with Ben-Hur, the original, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, you've seen the silent film from 1927?
I have seen the clips of it. Yeah.
Settle down, right?
Yeah.
The Sarah Encyclopedia cracks open.
Well, everybody goes the original, and I'm like, technically the Charlton Heston version is the third version.
Yeah, right. There have been many tellings of this. So just a real quick nutshell on this. This is a biblical spectacular.
Yep.
We have Judah Ben-Hur.
Yep.
And basically, he is... brother to Messala through mm-hmm. kind of a parental arrangement, right? Messala being a Roman,
yep.
Judah being a Jew, and...
They adopt Messala in.
Yep. Messala wants to make his own, so he actually goes off and joins the Roman army to prove his worth, comes back actually then to destroy the town. They're in Jerusalem. Yeah, so the Romans take over Jerusalem, and Judah Ben-Hur is then sent off to be a galley slave mm-hmm. by his own brother, Messala.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a, I don't know. I mean, it's the gist of it.
Yeah, it's still the reworking of Lou Wallace's.
Right.
It's Lou Wallace's epic classic novel, which is, it's a melding of a fictional story about a Jewish prince
mm-hmm.
and the story of the Christ.
Yep.
It is the story of Christ's crucifixion mixed in with this tale of revenge and forgiveness of Judah Ben-Hur and Misawa.
And that was, I mean, that
and
was kind
and
of
that
a,
is the story. That's always been the story. That's I mean, that's the book. That's the story every one of the adaptations tells.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, there's a chariot race in there in the end. And
what?
I mean, it's craziness, right? So we've got horses pulling chariots, and somehow Morgan Freeman winds in doing some narration, and Morgan Freeman winds up as the African who like fronts the money and fronts the horses and fronts.
Well, I mean,
Ben-Hur.
That character's in the book, though.
I know. So wait, but Morgan Freeman is their choice.
Morgan Freeman narrates Ben-Hur?
He does, actually,
Freeman
yes.
Morgan Freeman is going to narrate. And the like from the get-go, they open this, the film opens, and it's Morgan Freeman's voice. And I was like, oh, so we have God narrating. And it's like, oh, okay, it's not God. It's, you know.
Might as well be.
So here's the thing.
This sounds outstanding.
Well, so here's the deal. Both the best-known silent version, the 1927 version, and William Wyler's 1959 Oscar-winning epic with Charlton Heston, they are great movies. They are deserved classics. I don't think they're untouchable. You could do this story again.
Mm-hmm.
The issue with this movie is that it is tonally and structurally consistently at war with itself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something everybody should have realized right from the beginning.
Oh, and might we also point out, I mean, the costumes, there's a scene where they're wearing frickin' Levi's riding the back of a horse.
They looked like Levi's. They're actually not, but yes.
You should still catch that, though.
So, yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
Continue. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you read the production notes, everything in the film, including the costumes, is historically accurate. They just don't look
historically accurate.
On film, they don't look very good. We'll just say that they don't look of the material that they were made of.
So they unearthed a denim movement that we didn't know existed.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but back to my initial point.
Okay.
The producers of this movie are Roma Downey and Mark Burnett.
Uh-huh. There you are.
And they are known for their faith-based productions of The Bible and Son of God and Woodlawn, which was that football movie from last year. They make faith-based dramas that are very didactic in their sort of melodramatic presentation of biblical themes.
You are being very nice.
They hired as their director Timur Bekmambetov. I can never say his name quite right.
Just close enough.
But,
Timur.
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 He is the director known for... He's a Russian director known for Night Watch, Day Watch, and then his two big U.S. productions... Wanted and Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Yeah.
Who in their right mind puts those producers and that director together on a Ben-Hur movie and thinks to themselves, this is the way to go?
Yeah.
This was never... I actually don't mind some of Timur's movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually don't hate Roma Downey and Mark Burnett, although... I mean, some of their movies are really hard to sit through. I don't think they're horrible producers. Mm-hmm. I do think that they have brought some level of production value to their efforts.
Yeah.
But this never was going to work.
Uh-uh.
Timur Bekmambetov is all about the razzle-dazzle.
About bullets that curve.
Yeah. In many ways, he is a poor man's Michael Bay, and that is being kind. He loves CG. He loves to cut things like crazy. This whole movie, this whole story builds to that chariot race.
Yeah.
The chariot race in the 59 version is one of the great action sequences of all time, and it's known that way for good reason. It really is spectacular.
Yep.
I have no idea how many real horses were actually used in this production.
Yeah.
I have no idea how many real chariots were there. I have no idea what actually happened because it's all shot in these
incredibly
idiotic
tight scenes,
tight close-ups of Jack Houston as Ben-Hur looking all pensive and cutting constantly to Morgan Freeman barking out orders like he's a NASCAR pit crew chief.
Bring in your reins, bring in your reins. Come on, Judah.
You can't see anything that is happening during this chariot race.
Yeah.
And so it renders the most important sequence in the movie soulless.
By the way, Jesus makes several appearances in this film as a carpenter.
And then you juxtapose it with the faith stuff, which nobody is ever going to say that the William Wyler version of Ben-Hur is a subtle presentation of theological ideas.
No.
This movie makes that movie look like a modicum of subtlety.
Yeah.
It makes this movie... It just spells it all out.
Yeah.
It hammers it home. It slathers on the melodrama in a way that is just
the skies open, the god light shines down, and people
and
are
that's
cheering.
Your, that's your production crew, though. I mean, those elements tap directly into the projects producers. You mentioned. Yeah,
and so it never fits.
Yeah.
It's just it's a movie that is totally at war with itself consistently, making it just a bear to try to sit through.
So it's a skip from me, Sarah.
It's a skip. I mean, and it's just an annoying, frustrating, bizarre skip that should never have happened in the first place, at least not like this.
Reload, we'll try again some other time. But Mike, do tell us, Southside with you, this was something you had a chance to catch up with. Give us the kind of nutshell what's going on there. This is one that's beyond me, so explain to me like I'm five.
Yeah, it's actually a very simple premise. It's a story of two people, a man and a woman. They're both attorneys. They decide they're going to spend a day together. The woman says, this is not a date. This is not a date. She says it repeatedly. He's like, it could be a date. You know, we're just going to see where this goes. And it's literally a movie in the vein of Richard Linklater's Before series.
Most notably Before Sunrise.
Before Sunrise. Thank you. Even though it makes sense, I get those mixed up.
I would
up.
Throw in John Carney's Once as well.
Oh, yeah, right. That's another good example. Yeah. This is just a movie about two people that spend a day together walking in and around the South Side of Chicago.
Hmm.
Wait, also, it's Barack and Michelle Obama.
Oh.
On their first date. I forgot to mention that.
Is that who it's supposed to be?
Yeah. No, that's who it is.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's two actors playing them. I forgot to mention that, crazy enough.
Well, interesting. Fun side note. Okay. So, we're seeing the Obamas, kind of their romance story.
It is their first date. And the project came out of, and help me with the last name, it's Richard Tanney.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Correct.
He either read or heard, I'm not exactly sure, Michelle Obama recount the first day they met, the first date they went on. He took the bullet points of what she talked about, and he went, this could be a good movie.
He
went and he wrote the movie, filled in some speculative discussion. He took did a little bit of research, took the events, and he created this movie.
The movie is fictional. Yeah. So like the dialogue, what they talk about, what they do.
Yeah.
What they do is nothing. What they talk about and how they converse and what makes them sort of realize that there might be something going on here, that is technically fictional.
Right.
Where they actually go during the day is, according to the Obamas, reasonably accurate.
Okay. Right.
So the events happened. What they talk about is all speculative.
So, Mike, you're a married man.
I am.
Do you think your romance with your wife would be fodder for cinematic magic?
Absolutely not. No.
Okay. How does this pan out? I mean,
I'd like to believe so.
Yeah. So I mean, and how many couples do you think that would actually work? I mean, does this actually work? Do we care enough?
Here's the thing, I'll answer your question, but I want to tell you this. So I mentioned this to a couple of people, and I kind of took the same approach here, where I knew the premise and I told them about it, and they said, "Oh, that sounds really great." And I said, "Oh yeah, by the way, it's Barack and Michelle Obama that are the subject of the movie."
Yeah.
The response was, "Oh, really? That's interesting." Also, it was, "Oh, are you kidding me? What in the world?"
Yeah.
So, I can't answer the question of why did they make this movie? Because he wanted to. That's the only thing I can think of.
Hmm.
Why now? I don't know. It feels too soon. But it's terrific.
Hmm.
And the reason it's terrific is because it almost doesn't matter. In fact, the movie rarely mentions their names.
Yeah.
So what you end up getting is this story of two people that just spend a day together. And it's very much in the vein of Once and Before Sunrise. And those are all 5-star movies, and I get the names interchanged. And it works alarmingly well to the point where you're just sort of going through this day with them. And the best thing about it, one of the best things about it is there is a subtle use of culture in this movie. So they are going to an art installation at the Chicago Art Institute, and they're going to go see a screening of this movie, Do the Right Thing, that they've heard about. It seems like, you know, again, in a premise, that's a little heavy-handed. But what happens is they go to the art installation, and you hear or you look at the art of a painter named Ernie Barnes, and it's just sort of there. So you get this movie over the series of events. These are people learning about one another, but they're also learning about themselves. And there's an element of learning about their culture that is never heavy-handed, never over the top. It's just there, and it's part of their experience. And I will say it's one of the most interesting scripts for a film that has come along in a while. And it's acted so incredibly well. And I know Sarah and I were talking about Tika Sumpter.
I was going to say, who plays Michelle Obama. Tika Sumpter.
Or Michelle Robinson, actually, yep. at that
right,
time.
Right, right.
And just this performance she gives that is, it's tricky. I mean, also the gentleman playing, you know, Barack Obama has a really tricky element to his
Parker
performance.
Sawyers.
Parker Sawyers, his first lead performance.
Yep.
She, though, so there's these perceptions of Michelle Obama mm-hmm. that she kind of can't get away from, even as Michelle Robinson. So she's got to put that into the character. She also has to, you know, she presents as a proud, this is not a date, you are not going to win me over, we are friends, if even that, we are coworkers first, but she likes him. Mm-hmm. And she has to tell us that she likes him without allowing herself to believe that she likes him. And it's really a masterful performance, and it carries the movie to some great places. And I was really surprised by it. I thought it was going to be this kitschy, weird, political, heavy-handed thing, and this movie couldn't be less political if it tried.
Yeah.
And wow. that's and it's excellent.
It's barely 80 minutes.
Yeah.
It's over before you know it. Yes, they talk about some liberal ideas because that's who these people are, but the movie itself right. is amazingly apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, it's more a discussion about gender and race than it is anything
right.
else. And that's, again, a testament to Tika Sumpter's performance, because she has to deliver a couple monologues where she actually talks about gender and talks about race, especially in a white-dominated field that
mm-hmm.
of the law, and you know, especially in a big-time Chicago law firm. She has to deliver these in a way that feels honest and pure, but not preachy. And she does it.
Yeah.
She does it brilliantly. It's just a good movie. It's yeah. really entertaining.
So, because we got a lot of stuff yep. we want to get to as well on this, real quick. You're both real strong on this. You're saying theater on that.
I mean, strong theater.
Yeah. Yeah, I am too.
Just go in and just forget that it's about Barack and Michelle.
Uh huh.
I just want to add one 10-second comment.
Yeah.
This movie again, and there are some, you know, like Sarah talked about. There's a speech here or there. But this movie, for those of you that are out there that hear about this and think it's just some liberal hogwash or that
sure.
the mainstream media and the liberal Hollywood studios threw this together, this is a tiny film. They mm-hmm. had to fight to get this out there. And again, this is not a political movie. This is two people meeting, spending a day together, and perhaps falling in love.
That's
and,
it.
And it's just so tender and earnest and heartwarming. It's not what you think it is.
South Side with You.
Yep.
Okay. Sarah?
But that brings us to the big release.
The big release this week. A lot of tension in this one.
Yep.
Mike, you and I, we're going to have to hold our breath because this is Don't Breathe.
Okay, go ahead. Go. Your turn. You're up.
Okay.
No, you get to talk.
I get to talk. Okay. So Don't Breathe is the fall.
I can't.
Don't Breathe is the follow-up film for director Fede Alvarez and his co-writer Rodo Saiguez. I think I said that close to right. I'm not sure. But it's their follow-up to 2013's Evil Dead remake, which people either love or hate for some reason. There seems to be no middle ground there.
Yeah.
I loved it. I know Mike hated it.
Oh,
that's
I
just the way it.
It
works. So there yeah. we go. So we got two loves, one hate. Hey.
Yeah.
But it's their follow-up to that movie. And it's produced by Rob Tappert and Sam Raimi.
Mm-hmm.
But it couldn't be any more different than what Evil Dead was, even though it stars the same actress, Jane Levy. What this movie is about is a group of struggling Detroit young adults,
mm-hmm.
Somewhere in their late teens, early 20s, we're never really told,
mm-hmm.
who use one of the trio's connections to do a lot of home invasion robberies.
Mm-hmm.
But they do it when the people aren't home, and they only take low-ticket items. No cash, no big items.
Mm-hmm.
They do everything they can to make sure that their presence will never be investigated by law enforcement.
Hmm.
That is until they learn about a blind Gulf War veteran, the first Gulf War, played by Stephen Lang, who lives in a dilapidated part of town where nobody is around him at all,
mm-hmm.
who has $300,000 sitting in his home
mm.
in cash.
Hmm.
And they think to themselves, you know what? This will be an easy score. We'll be in. We'll be out. Nobody will get harmed.
The guy's blind.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah.
Everything is wrong.
He's got sonar on him like nobody can believe.
No, not really.
Oh.
No, but that's maybe a sequel.
Yeah.
Oh.
No. Stephen Lang, and he's just known as the blind man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, names aren't important for him.
He is living in a world of pain.
Mm.
His daughter was killed in a hit-and-run accident. There was no justice done. He mm-hmm. got this payout from the family. But he can't get over that.
Yeah.
And he lives in that pain every single day. when these people come into his home, he responds with violence. And he's very good at violence.
As you do. You're a soldier.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, yeah.
But there is more to the movie that you can't actually talk about.
Okay.
Nope.
Because there are other things that he has going on that he needs to protect other than just money.
Okay. So that being the case,
yes.
Where are you sitting on this? Where are you coming in on this? Is this a love?
This is a love, a close to love.
Okay.
I'm not as over the moon on it as some people have been, and I'm a huge horror fan, obviously, mm-hmm. and I like these kind of movies, and I love the Evil Dead remake. But there are moments where I'm looking at how the mechanics of this movie works, mm-hmm. the pieces that are being put together, how the filmmakers are leading us from A to B to C, and it's all perfect. Mm-hmm. But I find myself watching those and not getting emotionally invested in the characters. And that is a little tiny bit of a problem. I want to get emotionally, I need to be emotionally invested.
Yeah.
That said, it's unrelentingly tense and it's a crackerjack thriller. Not really a horror film, more a thriller.
Mm-hmm. Mike?
Oh, yeah. So Evil Dead was really not something I enjoyed at all. I found that to be just devoid of entertainment.
Did you enjoy the original Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 and then Army of Darkness?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I'm watching this thing and I really like it.
Do you really?
I really like Don't Breathe a lot.
What was the big seller for you?
The big seller for me is that it's not Evil Dead. And actually, here's the thing. I heard... I heard lots of people tell me why I was wrong on Evil Dead and there's artistry here and, Fede Alvarez has got just a vision and I'm like, no, it's
You
trash.
Saw it this time, didn't you?
Yeah.
Now I kind of see what some of you, not all of you, because some people were just a little too enthusiastic about Evil Dead, but what some of you told me I was missing is here in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is insanely intense from bell to bell, minus one sequence. I won't get into it. It just completely ruins the tension almost.
Mm-hmm.
And then he really quickly tries to ratchet it down the screws again to make it. And it's just a mess. But that sequence aside, this movie works so well because you kind of really think you know what's happening. And there's this great sequence in the beginning where, it's not spoiling anything to say they get into his house, right? I mean, you just said that.
Yeah.
So the camera kind of leaves them getting into the house, and it just swings through the house. And there might be an edit here or two, but it's showing you the lay of the land before sort of, this event, this war happens that you know is coming between him and them. And you see things, and it focuses on this, and it focuses on that. But
here's
you know
a
what?
Machete, here's a rifle, and here's the, a this.
And,
so.
And most movies are just gonna you're just gonna pay that off.
Yeah,
the machete's gonna be a part of things, and we're just gonna tell you that now. So he shows you things that don't matter, and he shows you things that do matter, and he plays around with things like that throughout the movie. So
here's
you're constantly,
a salad bowl.
But he also gives you, the geography, so that when they actually start running through the house, you know where they are going. You always know where they are at in relation to everybody else. So, if one person's downstairs in the laundry room, another person is upstairs in his bedroom, you know spatially how far apart they actually are.
And that's probably the biggest takeaway from this is that he gives you pretty much everything, and yet still has you nervous, anxious, gripping your chair. And again, I wish one 5-minute sequence didn't exist in the movie. But that aside, this thing, it's a pretty remarkable little piece of suspense.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
would you come in on a theater on that or okay.
If
I'm a theater and I would suggest you bring a turkey baster with you to the theater.
You need to stop now.
All right.
Crying out loud.
We'll let that sit where it is, and we'll try and figure out what that means. I'll just try and read between
How
the lines.
How dare you, Sarah?
I don't know what you're talking about.
So here's the thing, though. We've been discussing this as well. This summer has been, by some standards, this has been sort of a subpar summer.
People seem to keep saying that.
Right.
I mean, that seems to be the perception.
Mm-hmm. What's the deal? I mean, across the board, we have seen... I guess film takes at the box office historically low records. I believe it was AMC. There was a news story that I saw came out a couple weeks ago that was saying like attendance at the box office is like through the floor in comparison to last year and previous years. Like this is the worst year in history.
I don't think it's the worst year in history.
Maybe in the last few years,
it's certainly down from the last couple of years.
So is that? I mean. Where do we go from here?
But also the perception is that the year itself has just been a failure.
Mm-hmm.
That, and we're talking from a studio standpoint. We're talking from a major studio, big ticket feature standpoint. The perception is, other than Captain America Civil War at the beginning of the summer, and other than Finding Dory, it has been a failure of a summer because all of these movies have been terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Except that the movies themselves really haven't been terrible. There have been some notable misfires.
Mm-hmm.
It's that the box office take for a lot of these films just isn't what people expected them to be.
Mike, you've been a bit of a number cruncher on these sorts of things.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of left scratching my head, actually, literally, because I look at the slate, and I brought in a just a week by week, and I'm looking at some of these titles. You know, if we were sitting here, you know, and pardon me if you guys did sort of do a summer preview that I wasn't privy to, but, you know, you look at a Spielberg movie like the BFG, and you think, oh, that people love that book. It's an award-winning book. It's going to be, you know, that movie couldn't get arrested after its opening weekend. And you just go through this, and it seems to me that maybe the takeaway from the summer is just because you should, or just because you can, doesn't mean you should on some of these projects.
Sure.
Because you've got Alice Through the Looking Glass, which, you know, the first Alice in Wonderland, a lot of critics didn't like it. It did make a ton of money. So they're going, well, we need to do this again.
Photo whacking.
But you don't stop and think, enough time has gone by. Should, you know, where are we
too
at
much
in this
time
process?
Too much time went by. Flat out.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, we just, I mean, yes, Captain America Civil War made buckets of money.
Yeah.
But are people talking about it 3 months later?
Not really.
Not at this point.
It's in the ether. Nobody. Yeah. And I think that's just sort of the pattern. And then there's just some bad choices to go wide on some of these movies that are getting attention. You know, that, you know, Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates. You know, should that have been a summer tentpole movie that made $45 million at the box office? I mean, no.
Not even close. Yeah.
But, I mean...
Well, but that movie didn't cost anything. So let's be fair, but I'm just saying.
But the studio is still getting sort of... You know, that movie comes up as a studio, you know, a miss or whatever when you look at, like, the landscape of what these studios are putting out in the summer where they're trying to draw...
So I guess my question, though, to be to you guys, though, is... What is the perception and what is the reality?
Yeah.
Right.
I look at something like Ghostbusters.
Yep.
Ghostbusters is considered this massive failure. And yes, it's going to lose some money for Sony. I get that.
We may not get a sequel.
And we may not get a sequel for it, whatever. But were studio expectations for that movie much higher than what the reality really was ever going to be anyways? I mean, how much money was that reboot reimagining ever going to make? I mean, I think, personally, for the cast that is involved and for the time that has elapsed between, you know, Ghostbusters 2 to this reboot, I think the money it's made is right in line to what it probably should have made. I mean, I personally would have liked it to have made a little bit more. I liked the movie. I thought it was fine.
Yeah.
But was it ever going to... I mean, was a Ghostbusters reboot ever going to make $200, $300, $400 million at the box office?
I think that's a good question. And I think the thing that's striking me out of all of this, and I don't know if people are asking this question, but I think there has been perhaps a shift in society and what we now value our dollar, where does our entertainment dollar go? If I'm going to spend $12 to go see a film, it better be super amazing, or this better have serious accolades to it that have really drawn me in. I think folks are actually turning to I think this may be one of those instances where Netflix and the Redboxes of the world and the video on demand, that concept is perhaps starting to steal away the audience at the box office, or people are just hedging their bets going, it's probably not good enough, I'll just wait.
But why then did Jurassic World do so amazing last summer? I mean, phenomenal, beyond phenomenal. And Independence Day Resurgence, tank.
What's the difference? This is a quick shift in, I think, demographics. It has happened. We see it happening in radio. We see it happening in TV. We see it happening in all other forms of media, how people are accessing their media. That is shifting to the point now.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but you also have the window closing on theatrical to home access, right? I mean, so I have a... Xfinity or Comcast, whatever they're called. So, Bad Moms. Bad Moms opens in theaters July 29th. On July 30th, I have an option on my Comcast that says I can pre-order the movie, and when it becomes available on VOD, it's there in my DVR waiting.
Yeah.
You have that sort of continue to happen, and then people go, and Bad Moms was a huge hit, by the way.
But it's doing very well. It might end up making $100 million.
Right, but that's not an outlier. I mean, there's other films that's available. Mm-hmm. And so you start looking at that and you go, well, gosh, you know, I mean, I could go drop $50 on this with food and snacks, or I could just wait 3 months and it'll just be on my TV when I come home from work.
Yeah.
And that starts to become a factor into this where, you know, and yes, you still have Suicide Squad, which makes $150 million its opening weekend and, you know, whatever. And you, that's maybe a topic for another time, the whole critic versus, you know, public divide. But,
right.
But you know, you just start seeing this sort of shift like you're talking about. And maybe Jurassic World, there will be movies that make that kind of money again. Mm-hmm. And yet maybe that is a little bit of I don't know, a nostalgia piece that just had resonance. I mean, I didn't care for the movie, but I know a lot of people that felt like it was revisiting a childhood for them, and they got to share that with their kids. And so maybe that's a little bit of a different animal in this conversation.
Well, and I also think that's the perception of that was a continuation of a movie that is beloved. People
right.
really mm-hmm. like that movie. People enjoy Independence Day, but I don't think anybody will tell you that it's a great film.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just really quick, though, Adam, I mean, as far as stuff, though, that you wish you could just, like, these were awesome.
Right.
What to you, is what's, like, one movie from this last summer that you thought was awesome?
Yeah, so we'll do this round robin here.
And sure.
So each of these films, we'll just do two each.
Okay.
We can't repeat what the other says. So, like, if I say, I don't know, if I say I love Ghostbusters, go see Ghostbusters, you can't say Ghostbusters.
Okay, right. Yeah. So let me just ask a question. So I ranked a few here, but mm-hmm. are we just picking like our favorite or not? Or just
well,
random?
It's stuff people needed to see. People, yeah. they need to go watch it. This is proof that the summer was actually better than you think it was.
Okay, I'll start then that alters my list.
Okay, so I'll start with Captain Fantastic.
Ta-da! Nice pick. All right. Good pick.
Mike, okay. How about you?
I'm going to pick Hunt for the Wilder People.
Ooh, another good pick. I like that one.
Okay.
Beautiful film.
Yeah. I'm obviously going with Hell or High Water.
Okay.
You got to go see it. It's playing at the Cinerama. Go see it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, really? Oh, I know. I missed that. Okay.
Ooh, you want tickets? I'll get tickets.
Yeah, maybe. Okay. Yeah, we'll talk.
Another film that I thought didn't get its attention that I still think richly deserves attention, Nice Guys.
Totally awesome pick. Great pick.
Back in, that was back in May.
Yes. Hey,
started,
you know
started
what?
Off the summer.
Last summer, mm-hmm. The Man from U.N.C.L.E. failed, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This summer, Nice Guys failed. Both movies are from Warner Brothers. People, audiences, ticket buyers, this is why you can't have nice things.
Right.
You need to go to these movies, and that way Warner Brothers will keep making them.
Yeah, so Nice Guys coming in for me. Mike, how about you?
Well, I you know, I'm looking at this, and the movie that jumps out to me, and we talked about Kubo already, so the movie that jumps out to me, it's another independent movie, but it's a documentary that came out in May, and this guy is apparently doing the same thing he's been busted twice for, reportedly again, in terms of texting people inappropriately. This is a documentary about Anthony Weiner.
Which is awesome.
This documentary is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I think it's on VOD. Like, I think I could go home and watch it right now.
Yep, yeah, you could.
And it had a decent theatrical run. This guy, it's incredible.
Yeah.
You won't believe what you're watching. Yeah. And it's all real.
And Sarah, how about you? Where are you coming in?
So I'm not going to go. I have two movies that I think are the best of the year that came out this summer, but I'm not going to go with those.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go with a family movie that you need to go see. It's one of the best things I've seen so far this year. Pete's Dragon. Go watch it.
Oh, tearjerker all around. Yep. We've seen people love that up and down.
Yes, you need to. That movie needs to be a hit. Go watch it now.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, finishing off the summer of meh, kind of strong then.
Exactly. From some of these picks. There's stuff here. This was a good summer. It just wasn't the big budget stuff.
People just need to go see these things that are out there.
And I guess, we'll have to see how the social demographics work out and pan out later. This could be a new trend that we're seeing.
Yeah.
So that being the case, where did we come in this evening? Two strong theater recommendations for Don't Breathe. Southside with you getting two strong theater recommendations. Ben-Hur, total skip, flush it, don't turn around, and don't even question yourself on that one. War Dogs getting two skips. And Kubo and the Two Strings getting two strong theater recommendations.
Yeah.
Mike, you working on anything else right now?
I'm just actually trying to get through the summer of movie reviewing at this point. So, and then shifting to Oscar season in the fall and waiting to see what's coming. So just reviewing it, shouldiseeit.net.
Excellent. And Sarah, I know you've got a ton of stuff
that you
work on.
I just interviewed the programmer for the Cinerama Theater about his 70mm film festival.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to have that up next week so people can check that out.
And we'll have some of that audio coming up in a future show here
I
as well.
I hope so. That would be awesome. I also have reviews up for Hands of Stone, The Sea of Trees, one of the fabled Cannes Boo Fest. That opens this week. So I've got a review up for that, and I've also got a review up for Morris from America. And this weekend I will be putting up an interview with Richard Tanney, the director of Mike and I's wonderful little favorite movie of the weekend, South Side with You.
Which is getting a just enough of a release to be considered a wide release, by the way. I saw that today.
How about Yay. That? All right. Well, this has been Cinema Squabble, episode number 41. Thank you much for joining us. And if you get the chance to give us the likes, the thumbs ups, the stars, whatever it may be on Stitcher or iTunes or wherever you're finding us, we greatly appreciate it very much. Adam Gerke, Sarah Michelle Fetters,
bye-bye.
Mike Ward, thank you much for joining us, and thanks much to Sprint's Arbogast, our producer.